morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our calendar this morning is State versus Christopher Callaway. It looks like both of counsel are ready to proceed with that understanding, and each of you are aware of our rules on timing and what have you. Appellant may proceed whenever you're ready. Do give your name so that we've got that and the party you represent for the recording. You may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bradford Colbert. I represent the appellant in this matter, Christopher Callaway. This is a sentencing appeal, and we are arguing that this court must reverse the durational departure imposed upon Mr. Callaway. We're asking the court to reverse the departure for two reasons. First, because the district court did not provide any reasons to justify the departure. And second, because the Blakely waiver in this matter was inadequate. This morning, I'm going to focus on the trial court's failure to provide any reasons to justify the departure. I will, of course, be willing and happy to answer your questions regarding the inadequate Blakely waiver. As this court's well aware, the sentencing guidelines provide presumptive sentences. The presumptive sentences are to be used in almost every case. There is the court can depart from the presumptive sentence, but those should be rare. And they must be in cases where the crime is committed in a particularly serious way. In addition, a departure cannot be based on the plea agreement. The district court itself must make the determination that a departure is appropriate. And in order to enforce this principle that departures are to be rare, in State versus Williams, the Minnesota Supreme Court prospectively adopted a rule, a straightforward, simple rule that requires the district court to state on the record at the time of sentencing the reasons for departing. This could not be more clear. It could not be simpler.
So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding what you're arguing. So there was the departure worksheet that was submitted to the Sentencing Guideline Commission, and the district court judge there checked some of the boxes. And I don't think you're arguing, this is what I want clarification on, that those reasons were impermissible. You're just saying they weren't made at the time of the sentencing. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that if you look at in State versus Bernard, a case cited in my brief, an unpublished case from this court that says there were permissible reasons nonetheless, because the Williams rule, which again could not be more simple, the district court must state on the record at the time of sentencing. Williams also provided a remedy when the district court does not follow this simple rule. And it stated, if no reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Couldn't be more straightforward. 18 years after Williams in State versus Geller, the Minnesota Supreme Court reaffirmed Geller. And again, stated, absent a statement of the reasons for the sentencing departure placed on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Recently, just last year, in an unpublished decision, this court recognized that Williams and Geller are still controlling law. In sum, the case law on this issue is clear. When a district court fails to provide reasons for a sentence departure on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. So for over 30 years, the law has been clear and simple. When departing from a presumptive sentence, the district court must state the reasons for departing on the record at the time of sentencing.
It looks like at the very outset of the sentencing hearing, those reasons were stated by the prosecutor as sort of part of the plea agreement. You agree with that?
They talked about it, they discussed it, and again, that's not the law.
I understand. That isn't my question, whether that's the law. The prosecutor says, so the record is very clear, the reasons for the departure are the aggravating factors that exist, including the young age of the victim, the fact that there were three or more persons that were part of the commission of the offense and the particular vulnerability of the victim as she was sleeping at the time of the offense. So that's how they start out, right?
Correct.
And then at the end of the case, at the end of the sentencing, the district court, I don't have that page right here, I've got it somewhere, but I printed too many pages, says I'm departing based on the factors provided by law or something to that effect.
That's correct.
Wasn't he referring back to the statement by Ms. O'Brien?
I don't think so. I'm not sure what the court said, and the court correctly stated, based on the factors set forth in law. That doesn't refer to the factors set forth by the prosecutor earlier. If the court had said that, I think the state would have an argument. But based on the factors set forth in law could, and it certainly, I would suggest, means
any factor.
Absolutely. Based on the factors set forth in law for departing from the presumptive sentence. It does not limit it to this case, doesn't limit it to what the prosecutor said. It has no reference to anything.
Does it make a difference that just a couple of days later, the district court did a departure report identifying those very same factors that Ms. O'Brien had identified?
No difference whatsoever. Again, what is quite clear is it must be on the record at the time of sentencing. I believe in Bernard, I'm not sure it's that case, there was a departure report filed. But the issue here is, and again, it has to be on the record at the time of sentencing. The departure report, frankly, isn't even a court document.
No, it goes to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but it does end up in the court file.
Occasionally, I've seen cases not, but it's not a court official court document, and it goes to it, the purpose of it is for the guidelines to correct data, and if that had been that's and again, so it's done after. The other piece of this, of course, is that an oral pronouncement overrules anything written. And the oral pronouncement from this case is based on the factors set forth in law. And that is not sufficient. And I want to emphasize how simple this is. This is not a difficult task for the district court to set forth the reasons for departing.
So, Mr. Colbert, let me just test the rule. I think you have stated fairly, what Williams declares as well as the subsequent decisions that you've mentioned. Rule is district court must state it on the record at the time of sentencing. So what about the scenario where district court signs a sentencing order and says virtually the same thing that our judge said in this case, signs it on the same day as sentencing, but we also have the same record that we just have, oral record at the time of the hearing? What would your answer be to that? How would Williams apply?
I'm sorry, it's just to clarify. So the district court signed an order that said set forth the reasons for departing, the correct reasons?
My reasons for departure are, in the list that we have here from our district court judge, but the oral record at the hearing is the same as the one we have here.
In my brief, I've cited cases that say the mm-hmm. oral record controls.
But this is a sentencing order that happens after. Does that matter?
That's my question. The oral record controls. If there's a conflict between the two, which is what I would suggest would happen in that case, the oral pronouncement controls.
And you're certainly right in terms of if there's a conflict between what happens orally and what happens in the written record, that's been decided many, many times. I guess what I'm wondering about is this pronouncement in Williams that it be at sentencing and on the record. Does that mean it has to be on the oral record? I think it has been interpreted that way, and it's a fair interpretation of it. I'm just wondering whether that really makes sense if there's no conflict.
I guess my suggestion is yes, Your Honor, and the idea that we are supposed to take sentencing seriously. The idea this person is going to be sentenced, and in fact, this time.
Right, but aren't we taking it seriously where it's consistent, where the oral record is consistent with?
But I would suggest to you it's not consistent. If the sentence pronounced at the time on the record is based on the factors set forth in law and later says, here are the reasons I'm departing, I would argue that that isn't consistent.
Because
the set forth in law implies something completely different. That implies I don't know what it implies, frankly.
I would guess it's not so much that it's inconsistent, it might be vague.
Vague is charitable, frankly, right? I think what it's clear to me, and if you read the transcript, what the district court did was sentenced according to the plea agreement. This is not a situation where the district court did what it's supposed to do, in fact, to look seriously at the departure reasons and determine whether this is an appropriate case for a departure. That did not happen here. And I think that's evident by what the court said. If the court had said what it's supposed to do, it says, here's the presumptive sentence, and in looking at this case, it's appropriate to depart for the following reasons. I would not be here. But that's not what happened here. And if you read the record carefully, there is no question what happened here is the parties reached an agreement, came to agreement, and put that on the record. And that clearly is not appropriate. And
there was a slight change, though, wasn't there?
Excuse me?
Wasn't there a slight change between the agreement and what the judge eventually did?
It's a really, yeah. I think, and that's an important piece of it, Your Honor.
That's what I want to know. Why do you think that's important?
Because that's important because they didn't change the total sentence. So
total
what
number
they,
of months.
It's the same number of months. So what they said is, well, we miscalculated it. In fact, we're going to go down from 51 months for a departure to 48 months. So that, to me, says what they're looking at is the total sentence. They weren't looking at the departure. They weren't determining, here's an appropriate departure. Because what they, you know, what the idea was, here's a 51-month departure. And then all of a sudden, after they recalculated, they said, okay, now 48 months is appropriate.
So, and you're kind of quickly going through it. So we had an aggravated, in the plea agreement, aggravated robbery at the top of the box. So a guideline sentence.
So what happened
That was the plea agreement?
The plea agreement was, and I'll just walk through it, is the idea was originally he agreed to plead guilty for 129 months. And then what happened was they determined that there was out of the custody status points, so that moved up to 132 months. And so then they, because the total sentence they wanted to get to was 360, they then reduced the departure from 51 months to 48 months.
And that departure is based on the career criminal, right?
No. Their departure is based on the factors set forth in law. Okay. That's
Got
the
it.
Departure. That is the departure, what the court said.
And all of the reasons for a departure were stated on the record by the same ones that the judge put in the departure report were stated on the record by the prosecuting attorney?
Right. And again, I mean, looking through it, I mean, if you they discussed it, the idea of 609-1095, which is not really appropriate, they didn't charge that. Mm-hmm. So again, walking through those, that's not what's appropriate. What's appropriate to do here is, did the district court state the reasons for departure on the record at the time of sentencing? And what the court said, and I will read it again because I want to be clear, this is all the district court said. Pursuant to the plea agreement and based on the factors set forth in law, that is simply not sufficient.
Let's assume you're right about that for the moment, and that the departure was improper. The state contends that this was a package deal and he got rid of count one, which is an intentional second-degree murder, and so that if we send it back, the remedy ought to be either don't depart or deals off.
That's simply not the law.
And why is that not the law?
Well, it's quite clear because that's exactly the argument the state made in State versus Geller and State versus Rano. And the Supreme Court said in State versus Geller that it must be stated on the record at the time of sentencing. And even more explicitly, if you look at State versus Rano, that's exactly what the argument the state made, exactly the same argument. The state said, you know, this is part of a package deal. It must be pursuant to either we must remand for resentencing or we must, in fact, it's part of the plea agreement.
So and you're Renaud, saying Geller and Rano are both plea bargain cases?
Both plea bargain. Yeah. And Rano says and walks through those particular remedies, and the court obviously considers them. And Justice Wright says, clearly, note, because the district court become the guidelines according to plea agreement, you know, maybe Miskwidus, maybe Lewis applies rather than Geller. But then the court says, and in no uncertain terms, in a published case, notwithstanding this, Geller's mandate is clear. Absent a state of reasons for the sentencing departure placed on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Could not be more clear. Published decision from this case, based on a decision from Minnesota Supreme Court. And again, this is because of the principle, the basic principle of sentencing in Minnesota is presumptive sentences should be the norm. If you're going to depart, we are going to create an incredibly simple rule for you to depart. If you don't follow this incredibly simple rule, we're not going to allow the departure. And I suggest you look at State versus Giller, in which the state asked the court to say, we want to more clearly mandate that the defendant be informed of the reasons for the departure at the time of sentencing, and that the sentencing transcript reflect this reasons for departure. That's what the state is asking for, and that's what the Supreme Court said in Geller. This is required. And
so,
that's
one last, I'm just doing the arithmetic then. So top of the box in aggravated robbery is 132. Mm-hmm. Top of the box in second degree felony murder, 228.
No, it's 180, I think. So, if, and again, I mean, I'm afraid I can't do the, but my impression was it was the 48 months was the departure.
Right.
And the top of the box for a second degree felony murder is, I believe, 180. But I can't promise that.
It was 221 in the plea agreement and went up to 228 after the correction of the criminal history.
And again, the total sentence remained the same.
Right.
Because, but I'm sorry, I can't have.
You just subtract the 48.
That's what we'd be asking for, to remove the departure.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Mr. Raggetts.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. I've got five things I want to say this morning on appellant's two arguments, starting with the argument about the appropriateness of the departure. First of all, as appellant has essentially acknowledged, it's not true that Judge Austin didn't say anything about the departure. He said, as we've discussed, pursuant to the plea agreement and based on the factors set forth in law. But it's important that this is just after the prosecutor, as you pointed out, Judge Rodenberg, said, just to be perfectly clear, here are the reasons for the departure. And then that's discussed on pages 3 through 6 of the sentencing transcript. And then on page 20 of the sentencing transcript, the defense says, yes, we agree with all that. We are asking you to impose the sentence that we've all agreed on as part of this plea. So this case is very much like the Bennett decision cited in my brief, where the judge said the departure was based on the reasons of the agreement of the Blakely factors. So, and this court said that is enough. That's adopting the reasons that have already been set out. That's what happened here. Judge Awesome adopted the reasons that had just been set out minutes earlier in detail, agreed upon by the defense, for the departure. It probably would have been better if Judge Awesome had repeated everything that had just been said. But he didn't have to do that to adopt the reasons here. This is not a case where there's a dispute about the departure factors. They're controversial. They were agreed on here. And even on appeal, appellant doesn't dispute that the three or more people alone supports the departure. And appellant clearly admitted that. So this is very much like the Bennett decision. And we have an adoption here by Judge Awesome of something that everyone agreed on at length. So that's point number one of why the departure was appropriate. Point number two here is we do have the departure report, and that is part of the sentencing record. Judge Bradfold, that's what you wrote in the Ali decision just recently. And to rule in appellant's favor,
it's
you'd have to hold...
It's an unpublished decision, though.
It is, but it's persuasive, and Ali would have to be wrong for appellant to be right, because both cases you have judges in writing setting out the reasons for the departure.
But it might be better to focus on Williams.
Well, Williams
and the other cases have been mentioned by the appellant. We are bound by the Supreme Court precedent.
Right, but none of those cases involve a departure report. I think that's critical here. You don't, if you read those cases, not a single one says, oh, but there was a departure report and it wasn't good enough, or even reference whether a departure report existed.
So what you're really saying is the Supreme Court hasn't looked at this issue?
Right, but you have in Ali, and the Ali decision is persuasive. On Ali, you pointed out that a sentencing order is part of the sentencing record. Well, a departure report is part of the sentencing record, too. It was within 2 business days in this case. If it had been weeks or months later, maybe we'd have a problem. But this was within the deadline of the requirement of a sentencing report, and it sets out what everyone agreed on. It would also perhaps be different here if the reasons for the departure had not been discussed at length in both the plea hearing and the sentencing hearing. If there had been
I guess what's troubling in the record, though, counsel, and you use this language, the judge adopted the reasons already set out, but the judge doesn't say that. I mean, I think to be fair to Mr. Colbert and the appellant's argument, that's what they're saying, is that the judge wasn't that clear.
Well, the judge didn't say that in Bennett either. The judge just said, for the reasons we've already heard. And that's essentially what happened here, too. And the judge mentions...
Arguably, there is a difference between saying, as our judge did here, for the reasons set out in law, which is, there are a lot of reasons set out in law, and between saying for the reasons that were already discussed, because that narrows the range of reasons.
But I think it's important here that the judge doesn't just say for the reasons set out in law. The judge says pursuant to the plea agreement, and the plea agreement sets out the particular factors that everyone agrees applies here, that were negotiated, and that the defense said should be a basis. So appellant's making a very formalistic argument here. There was no dispute about the appropriateness of the departure factors, about the general number that everyone agreed on. This isn't a case where the parties just came up with a number and didn't have any departure factors. We know you can't do that because that would undercut the uniformity that the sentencing guidelines call for. But here we have departure factors that no one disputes support this departure. The three or more people, the eight prior felonies, the victim being a minor and asleep at the time. That's not in dispute at all. This was an agreement. And where you have a judge referencing the plea agreement that has been set out in detail and in the written form, too, for the departure factors, that's enough under Bennett. And the departure report is enough under the persuasive Ali decision. Again, there's no case law that contradicts either of those arguments. There's
It's worth noting, though, that Bennett is itself unpublished, right?
Right. Yeah, those are both. I'm wrong on both of those for the persuasive value. But I think it's also worth noting that there aren't any published decisions from this court or any decisions from the Minnesota Supreme Court that contradict either of those results, that say, no, a report or an order isn't good enough, or no...
Well, implicitly, Williams and other cases that refer to the reasons for departure must be stated on the record at the time of sentencing. And I think that the deeper answer to that, you know, as articulated by a counsel today, is to look at our longstanding rule that the oral pronouncements at sentencing are the sentence. I mean, that is what the sentence is. It is not whatever contradictory information might be given in writing in various court documents, which would include a departure report.
Right. That would mean Ali was wrongly decided, and I don't think it was, because there's no conflict here between the oral and the written. Everyone agreed on this sentence, and the judge referenced the plea agreement. And again, I think it's critically important here that at just minutes before, the prosecutor had set out in detail the departure factors. No one ever disputed that. The defense said, yes, those are the departure factors. We agree with those. So this is not a case where the appellate court needs to be able to evaluate, well, were these appropriate departure factors or not? Everyone agrees they're appropriate. The question is, did the judge have to say, I'm going to repeat what the prosecutor exactly said here, or can I just, by shorthand, refer back to it? Bennett says you can refer back to it by shorthand, and that's what happened here. There's no dispute that everyone agreed on these departure factors at the time. So I think under Bennett and Ali, which are both persuasive, you should uphold the departure here. And I think it's really important, again, that there aren't any published decisions that go against that. None of the decisions involve a departure report. There aren't any decisions that say adoption by the judge isn't enough. The judge has to verbatim repeat the departure factors and not just refer back to what's already been said. So this is new ground in that respect. And there's no public policy or fairness or justice reasons to overturn the departure here when everyone agreed on it.
Well, there is that it wasn't done in conformity with Williams.
Well, Williams doesn't...
That might be a good reason in itself, that the district court didn't do what the Supreme Court said it had to do.
Well, Williams doesn't say you can't adopt what's already been set out. Williams...
No, what Williams says is the district court... I mean, let me get the exact language. The reasons for departure are stated on the record at the time of sentencing.
But they were here. I think that's very important. They were stated on the record by the prosecutor. No one ever disagreed with those. So this is all part of the record. The judge didn't say, hey, you remember those 5 minutes you just heard? I'm going to repeat those 5 minutes now. And the judge just referred back to that.
You have less of a record than that, though, Mr. Agatz. You don't have a district court judge that says, let's refer back to what the prosecutor says. You have a district court that just refers to the law. Which
well,
is a, there's a difference.
No,
there.
The prosecutor, the judge says pursuant to the plea agreement, and the prosecutor has just said
that's a that's recognized as not a reason for departure.
Well,
right? I mean, there's a lot of black letter law that says.
Well, you're right. You can't depart just because everyone's agreed on a certain number, but you can depart because everyone said as part of the plea agreement, both sides agree these departure factors are present. That's the critical distinction. You can't say everyone says 360, so I'm going with 360. But you can say everyone agrees that 360 is appropriate given these well-recognized departure factors, and that's what we have here. We're not just deviating from the sentencing guidelines because the parties think it's the right thing to do. We're deviating from the sentencing guidelines here because there are well-recognized, undisputed departure factors that apply here. So that's where this is a very formalistic argument that doesn't serve justice or public policy because everyone agreed on this. And now appellant's essentially looking for a way to get out of his plea agreement, and I guess that goes to the remedy issue. And I read the Williams, Geller, and Rano decisions pretty carefully, and I don't recall them saying anything about a package plea. Appellant can correct me if I'm wrong on rebuttal, but I don't believe any of those cases discussed a package situation and say, even though the state gave up some things for part of this plea, defendant, you're still entitled to all the things you like, even though you've attacked the things you don't like. And I've cited the case law in my brief that says a plea package is like a contract. You can't pick and choose pieces out of it. If appellant's rejecting the parts of the plea that the state got, he's not entitled to keep what the state gave up. And the state gave up here a second-degree intentional murder charge, a criminal damage to property charge, and the ability to argue for a double upward durational departure here. The departure here is substantially less than is allowed by the law. So the state gave up many things here, and none of the cases appellant cites say in that situation you can't withdraw the plea.
Well, Rano was a case where there were a plea to five counts of 10 counts. I don't know all the details, but it was sort of a package deal.
But there's no discussion in Rano of the whole package plea doctrine here. They don't, maybe that argument wasn't raised. I don't know what the state gave up there. I mean, sometimes counts that are dropped are basically alternative counts. There's just no case that directly deals with this principle head on. And the cases do set out the principle that plea agreements are like contracts. You can't pick or choose what you get to keep and what you get to reject. That's an important principle.
I didn't look at the sentencing guidelines for your count one, but I believe, isn't second-degree intentional murder a higher-level offense than the one of which he was convicted?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And there's also the criminal damage to property, and there's also the fact that this was a relatively small upper departure, whereas with all these factors here, the state could have certainly argued for a double upper durational departure.
And there's at least some circumstantial evidence that he did intentionally kill the person.
There is. I think he admitted that he intentionally shot into the car where he knew there were people. But here, there's no dispute that there were three or more people involved. That's all you need for an up to double upward durational departure.
Yeah, I'm focusing now on the package question.
Right.
That is to say, the state's concession here of dismissing count one was a meaningful concession.
It was, Your Honor, and it was also meaningful that the only upper departure was 48 months when it could have been up to double given all the departure factors we have here. So I think when you look at the case law, there simply isn't any that says the package plea principle doesn't matter here. What the cases essentially say is if you challenge a sentence, the judge can't later go back and say, oh, well, yeah, now I'll come up with some reasons for the departure. The state here on remand would not be asking for a departure. It would be asking for the ability to withdraw. So it's not like the cases where the state has said, well, everyone knows what the reasons were, just let us explain those later. If you remand here, the state should be able to go back to square one, and appellant can either go to trial or negotiate a different deal under the cases I've set out. I do want to talk quickly, if I can, about the Blakely waiver issue. Appellant hasn't addressed that today. But again, there's case law that's favorable to the state on that that says, and this is set out in my brief, when you've got an exhaustive waiver of rights as part of a plea, you don't need to redo an exhaustive waiver of rights as part of Blakely. And that makes sense. You've already heard what all your rights are. You've given them up. It's enough for the judge to do something a little more brief after that. And here we have extensive discussion of appellant talking to his attorney about what a Blakely waiver is. Appellant says he knows he has the right to a mini trial on the sentencing factors, and he's giving them up. If you look at the plea transcript, he doesn't have any questions on page 13. He doesn't have any questions on page 21. He understands on page 18. He understands on page 73. There's an exhaustive discussion here of him knowing what he's giving up and what he's agreeing to in terms of the sentence and the departure factors. So under the cases set out in my brief, That was enough. There's no case law that contradicts that. And finally, this is my fifth point, any error here was harmless. It is clear that Blakely errors can be harmless. No case has ever held they're structural. And appellant says, well, the cases I cite for that are guilty plea cases. They're not, or trial cases, they're not guilty plea cases. But no case law distinguishes between those two circumstances. No case law says, well, if you have a guilty plea, then Blakely errors are structural and aren't subject to harmless error analysis. Well, any error here in the waiver was harmless because appellant admitted that three or more people participated. So the facts are undisputed and well-established. Even if that issue had gone to a jury, there's no reasonable possibility they would have found appellant acted on his own or with just one other person. It was harmless here, given what he admitted at length. Appellant says, well, he admitted that as part of the guilty plea, not as part of the sentencing. But that doesn't matter for harmless error analysis. What matters is the facts are undisputed and clear. There were three or more people. It's also undisputed and can't be disputed that he has eight prior felonies, and that was one of the grounds relied on for the departure here. So any error here in the waiver was harmless. But if you look at the case law and look at all the discussion of the waiver here, it was sufficient in light of the plea agreement waiver of rights, and appellant has never argued that his plea agreement's invalid, that those waivers were insufficient. So you have to look at the whole package here, and when you look at the package of waivers, they were enough under the case law. And since I only have 33 seconds left, unless this court has additional questions, I simply ask that you affirm Judge Awesome and appellant's sentence.
It appears we have none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Colbert, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you would like to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state's offered to stand up on rebuttal and prove the state wrong, and I will take the state up off the offer. Actually, in Renault, this Court of Appeals published decision directly addressed the issue of whether withdrawing from a plea is a proper remedy. They said, they're quoting, in State versus Lewis, the Minnesota Supreme Court stated that, in addition to considering departure factors and remand, the district court may also consider the effect that changes in the sentence have on the plea agreement. The district court was authorized to consider motions to vacate the conviction and plea agreement under those circumstances. It then goes on to say, but the Geller mandate is clear. Absent a statement of the reasons for departure placed on the record at the time of sentencing, no departure will be allowed. Given the breadth of this most recent holding, we follow the rule announced in Geller and remand for the imposition of a sentence that does not constitute a departure from the sentencing guidelines. Could not be more clear, addressed exactly what the state is attempting to argue here, that they can somehow withdraw from the plea agreement. The Supreme Court has said the rule regarding departure is clear. And then the state says there's no justice involved. And I guess I would just fundamentally disagree. This is the purpose of the sentence. The purpose of a sentencing is for the district court to look at the defendant and say, here's the sentence, and here's the reasons why you're getting this sentence. The judge is imposing the sentence. It is the judge, in fact, that has to take responsibility for saying, this is the appropriate sentence, this is why I'm giving you the sentence, and I'm departing from the presumptive sentence because of these reasons. That's our system of justice in Minnesota. That is, I think, if not the most fundamental, certainly one of the most fundamental aspects is the judge. If you look at the case cited, State versus Bernard, the Court of Appeals, this court, addressed several of the arguments that the state is making here. The state argues that the first Williams rule merely requires that the reason for departure appear somewhere on the record, whether through a judge, the attorneys, or other means. That's not the way our system works. That's not the way sentencing should work. We're just asking for this court to recognize that a sentence should be imposed by the judge, and if the judge is going to impose a departure, that it state the reasons for the departure on the record at the time of sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument.